David F. DeHart, born in Oregon in 1936, and I live in Wilsonville, Oregon, with my wife, Wendy.
So how did you decide to join the service?
Well, I was a student at Benson High School in the early 50s, and many of my classmates were dropping out of school and joining the military, and I had always wanted to be in the service. My father was in the Navy during World War II, and I was really interested in getting to that 17th birthday. And when that date arose, I went downtown Portland and to the recruiting office, and I said, I want to join the Navy. And he said, well, son, have you finished high school? And I said, no, I'm a junior. He said, well, go back and finish high school and come back and talk to me. So here this lifelong dream was diffused in a heartbeat. And as I was walking down the hall, this soldier came out of an office, a paratrooper, with all of the decorations and everything. And he said, so son, the Navy don't want you. Ever think about being a paratrooper? Well, 2 weeks later, I was on my way to the 11th Airborne Division, Fort Campbell, Kentucky, for basic training as a paratrooper. So that's how I got in.
All of a sudden.
Yes.
Great. What was going on in the world about that time?
The Korean War, of course, was big time. The North Koreans invaded the South in 1950, and so immediately the draft went into effect. It's interesting that the Oregon National Guard sent some of the and Washington National Guard sent some of the first troops to the Korean War, and whether or not they were ready or close, whatever, I don't know their reason, but many of them left here. So there were a lot of us in Oregon that knew people whose fathers, sons, brothers, whatever, uncles had been called up and were serving in the military. So that was the all-encompassing thing. Every high school student knew that if he graduated and didn't go to college, he would be drafted. He'd be on his way. In my yearbook of a 1952 yearbook at Benson, there are four or five students in there wearing uniforms who were been called up and were in the military at that time. So,
what was your major at Benson?
Pardon?
What was your major at the Benson High School?
Oh, music.
Music.
I played in the Benson Band and in the men's glee. All the time that I was there.
But they didn't put you into the band for the Army then?
No. Years later, it's about 5 years later, matter of fact, I auditioned for the bass band at Fort Benning, Georgia, which is a huge band. And I played sousaphone, tuba, recording bass, all the low brass instruments, baritone and so forth. And they said, well, they had a marching band. They weren't concerned about orchestra. They had a marching band, and they had all the tubas that they could take. So I never went beyond that point.
So you got to use the music again, anyway.
I did. Yeah.
That's great. So tell us about your first days in training and how that went. What was that like?
First day is interesting. Leaving Portland. My orders to bringing me on active duty had a list of, I think, probably 40 people from Portland area that were on there being shipped to Fort Lewis for induction. One of them was a local DJ by the name of Tiger Branch. His real name is Marion Branch, and he was on a radio station called Kissin, the first Kissin radio out of Vancouver, Washington. And Tiger was the idol. He was the big guy, you know, of this area. And, but he was drafted. I was the only enlistee on all of those orders out of 40 people. Everybody else were draftees. And poor Tiger and I served KP together up at Fort Lewis. The first day we arrived there, we were assigned to KP duty. And that poor guy, they put him on pots and pans, and he was breaking out from the lye soap, and it was just his first day in the military was not a very nice experience. To me, I loved it. It was like, wow, this is it. You know, I'm finally made it. I'm in the Army now. You know.
How long were you there at Fort Lewis?
We were only there for about a week, and that was to be issued all of our gear and have orders cut because everybody just went all over the place. I was the only one at that time that was going to 11th Airborne Division at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. two of my my neighbor friends I grew up with in Southeast Portland also joined about that time, and they showed up later at Campbell, also paratroopers. So,
so training was the next step. How did that go?
16 weeks of basic training in with the 11th Airborne, Fort Campbell. Arriving there in March, and it was cold, extremely unusually cold for that time of the year. But by the time our 16 weeks of basic training was over, it was about 104 degrees and about 150 humidity. It was just a miserable place to take basic training. I was initially assigned to the 88th Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion of the 11th Airborne Division, but they're artillerymen, but they're training us to be infantrymen, which was kind of interesting. And from there, we went through pre-jump training and then jump school at Fort Benning, Georgia. The last week after the second jump, I tore an ankle all up. In fact, it still hurts today. And so that took care of my airborne training. And was immediately, this is in 1953, was immediately put on the list for Korea, and where I went in early 1954.
What was that first jump like?
It's interesting, and you go through all of the training, you're ready for it. So you really don't think about the danger or the excitement or anything. The excitement is accomplishing that first jump, not, you know, jumping out an airplane. We were jumping out of C-47s at that time. Later, they went to larger wide-door aircraft, and we're jammed in there like sardines, and everybody is loaded down with about 50 pounds of equipment. I weighed a whopping 128 pounds at that time. I was only 17 years old, you know. And they had to weight me down with a general purpose bag that had a radio in it to put some weight on me. They were afraid that once I left the aircraft, I would continue to rise and disappear into the heavens. So they'd weight me down with all this equipment. By the time I stood in got the order, stand in the door with the next orders to exit, that cold blast of air felt so good, I just welcomed it and didn't even think about what would take place next.
So where was the next assignment then? Training ended, but you got sent direct to Korea?
Yes, right. Actually, at that time, the system was called the pipeline, which means everybody goes into the pipe. And at the other end, there's a personnel specialist who interviews you and looks at your records. And I remember at that time, which was back at Fort Lewis, by the way, we were either going to Japan, Okinawa, or Korea. And two people in front of me had J's stamped on their file, meaning Japan. And when I got there, he says, what's your training? I said, well, I really don't have anything. You know, I just washed out of jump school, and he put K. So off to Korea I went. And I was that was somewhat frightening to me. It was right at the end of the war, but there were still a lot of North Koreans in the southeastern part of the country that didn't know the war was over yet. We were all loaded up on a troop train. We landed in Busan, the southern tip of Korean Peninsula, loaded on a troop train Christmas Eve. A lovely day. The windows had been shot out of this train. It was about 20 degrees outside and snowing. The train was like a freezer. And we were on that train for a day and a half to get to Seoul, where we would be again, you know, filtered into various organizations. Windows had been shot out of this train, and it was not a welcome to Korea experience. But it's interesting. I went by troop ship, both coming and going. Went on the walker on the way over out of Seattle, and 21 days in the dead of winter in December on a North Pacific cruise to Korea, where the waves averaged probably 30, 40 feet the whole trip. So you had 1,500 seasick soldiers on that ship with no place to go. No way to get away from anything. It was an absolute nightmare. We made a quick stop in Yokohama, Japan. We couldn't get off, but we stopped there. And the next day, or that night, we took off sailing toward to Busan. The next morning, I had topside duty. You know, they keep you busy. They assign you to these fictitious guard posts all over the ship just to keep you. And I happened to have a guard post on topside, and I'm huddled up in a parka, trying to keep warm and dry. And all of a sudden, morning came, and the sun rose behind us, and the chop stopped. Maybe it's because we were coming into the bay, but it was smooth sailing, and it was a beautiful, gorgeous day. And I could smell earth. I could smell the country. And it was a very sweet aroma, not like when you land in Hawaii. I mean, this country had just been decimated. There were no infrastructure left, no roads. All the buildings were bombed. There was just nothing of any beauty left in it, except the beauty of that morning. And I remembered that Korea is called the land of the morning calm. That's its motto, or its whatever. You know, and like the land of the rising sun in Japan, the land of the morning calm. And that's exactly the way it was. So that was interesting. From then on, I spent a year as a truck driver, driving a deuce and a half, driving prisoners back on the prisoner exchanges that were going on at that time. And toward the end of my 12-month tour, President Truman decided that we should spend another 6 months there. Does that sound familiar? So we called that the Truman year. And however, during that period of time, I'd been promoted to corporal and went through some supply training and was transferred to another unit as a supply sergeant for the last 6 months. So coming back home, right, to Incheon Harbor, to get on board another ship, the sister ship of the Walker called the Breckenridge. And by now, young 18-year-old David DeHart is a little more savvy about things. And as soon as I got on board that ship, where they're directing you where to go, I said, I'm here to sign up for crew staff. And he said, sure, son, we can always use crew staff. So they sent me down to sign up for crew staff, meaning you actually work with the crew, as opposed to just sitting around vomiting and drinking milkshakes and vomiting more, you know, along with 1,500 other people. So when I checked in, he says, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a clerk typist. He said, great, we need somebody to type a smooth log. One a day, that's all we need. It comes down from the bridge, and it has to be typed absolutely perfect, no erasures whatsoever, and then three copies with carbon paper. And so I said, fine. So it's above board. So you're midships topside, where you have very little movement. It was just perfect spot for me. Plus, we slept topside in cabins up there, not down in the, you know, with the slaves in the bottom of the ship. You know? So anyway, my first day at typing a smooth log didn't go too well, because I didn't know how to type. I could hunt and peck a little bit. I still do. Use four fingers on the left hand, one on the right. That's the way I type my novels, you know. This chief yeoman came over, and he's looking at the wastebasket, and here's all of these wadded up forms piled. He said, maybe it's a little distracting here with all the other activities, so I had to pick your typewriter up and get all your stuff and follow me. So he took me down a corridor into a room, an officer's room that was vacant, not being used, and he said, all right, this is your office. You can sleep here if you want. There's a bunk. But you're all alone. All I want is one error-free log sheet every single day. Is that all right? Can you do that? Well, some of these logs, it would be something simple, like cruising and steaming underway en route 2, San Francisco, California, and it had the bearing and all of that, and anything else that may have occurred during the night. But if there was nothing, it was just like basically one little short paragraph, you know. And I got so I could type a paragraph like that and only waste about, oh, maybe 6 or 7 of these forms, special forms they had. By the time we got to San Francisco, I was an expert at it. I really learned to type during the latter part of 21 days of that cruise. So.
And this was before electric typewriters, of course.
Absolutely. This was on an old upright Underwood typewriter, like you see sitting behind Andy Rooney on 60 Minutes on his shelf back there. Yeah.
And you said carbon paper was?
Oh, yes. You had two sheets of carbon. So yeah, with no mistakes, if you made a mistake, you had to trash the whole thing, take the carbon out and get three more forms and set them up again and start all over. So.
So after that tour, were there more then?
Let me tell you about my homecoming first, if I may.
Sure.
Because this is important to me. If you go onto the VFW's website, I have two short stories published on that website called Homecomings. And in that, I'm juxtapositioning my arrival back home from Korea in 1956 or 55 to my arrival back in coming back from Vietnam. The difference in the two. When that ship entered the San Francisco Harbor, these are the original photographs that I took. Here's a picture somebody took of me standing, waiting to come into, coming ashore. And this was my first sight of the Golden Gate Bridge from the ship. And then this is a picture of going underneath. All the fireboats were in the harbor, shooting water up in the air as a celebration. All of the small craft were out there with flags waving and welcoming us to San Francisco. We pulled up the dock at Fort Mason. The 6th Army Brass Band was on the deck, marching up and down, playing various marching songs. Hundreds of people were down there, waving flowers and banners, particularly the wives, spouses, and you know the women of the family welcoming their loved ones home. And we came down off of that gangway. I just felt so great. I felt so proud. I mean, I could almost burst from pride, having come back from Korea and having being met that way. It was absolutely amazing. As each of us came off of the gangway, a little girl gave us a red rose to take with us. And then we were just released to the winds go, you know. And I was on my way back to Portland, and I took a train out of San Francisco to Portland, and the bar was open. We could not buy a drink. As a matter of fact, the conductor came through and he said, these servicemen can only have two drinks. That's it. We don't want any drunk soldiers on board. And so they can't buy more than two drinks or get served two drinks. And there was a woman, probably in her 40s or so, sitting by herself. And there were about 10 of us crowded into the lounge. And she told the bartender, 10 more beers, please, for me. So she's, I mean, it was absolutely wonderful, right? So I spent my 30-day vacation in Portland and then reported in the 47th Artillery Brigade down at in Los Angeles at San Pedro. Wonderful assignment, where I was the chauffeur for the post commander, the commanding general down there for 2.5 years. That was the next assignment.
So what did that involve? Just driving a special vehicle?
Yeah, well, it wasn't really, it was a 1956 Chevy sedan, but, you know, nothing fancy, but I mean for military, black, of course, with a little red star on the front bumper and all of that. And it meant going to Bob Hope's home for parties. You know, when he would go to Korea, and do his, he would have the pre-launch parties, and he always invited the general. And wherever I went, the chauffeurs were always the same people. You met the same from various places. And we would usually end up in the kitchen where they would feed us, and we could see what's going on. I sat in the kitchen with the door cracked open once and listened to, at the Friars Club, and listened to the super secret roast of Humphrey Bogart. When Lauren Bacall was asked to come in and comment, and she's the first time a woman had ever spoken at a Friars Club roast before. And, you know, little things like that. We'd go to Disneyland and Marineland 5 times a month at least. I got to the point where I would just sit in my car and read.
Did you get to meet Bob Hope or anyone?
Oh, yes.
Famous?
Yeah, Bob Hope. And he would give us all little gifts. And we went to a lot of functions. Los Angeles in the 50s. Was a great city. It was the, you know, the rise of rock and roll, and it was just an awesome time to live. Well, as you may well know, the 50s was a wonderful time. I call it the boring, bland, you know, era of the 50s, because nobody smoked dope other than musicians, of course, you know, professional musicians. You know. It was just a great time to and place to be in the 50s.
So then what?
The general, this was a turning point in my life, too. The general was reassigned. He was promoted to a two-star general and was reassigned to Colorado Springs to the headquarters for NORAD, the North American Defense Command. And he told me, he says, I already have a chauffeur there assigned to me. So, Dave, you tell me what you want to do and I'll see if I can arrange it. What would you want to do? And of course, I was a career man. I would always wanted to put 20 years in the military anyway. And he said, so what do you want to do? You think about it and let me know in the morning. Next morning, I said, I'm going to go to the Army Language School in Monterey. He said, what do you know about the Army Language School in Monterey? And I said, absolutely nothing. I just heard that it was a good opportunity to learn a foreign language and to visit a friendly foreign country. I'm going to take any language but Korean. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. He says, you go over and you take the Army Language Aptitude Test. And if you qualify, I'll see what I can work out. So I did. And as luck would have it, I have an affinity that I wasn't aware of for languages and assimilating languages. And the test is nothing more than learning Esperanto and conjugating verbs in Esperanto after a brief little, and this is all part of the test that you go through it. And I scored very high on the ALAT test without ever even thinking about such a thing before. And so when the next day the old man told me, he said, all right, there's two courses will be available to start. These are year-long courses. And there's only two that start about the time that I leave. One is Turkish and the other is Russia. Well, of course, this is the Cold War. So where would I go speaking Russian? Somewhere up on a border in a listening post. You know, so I said, I like Turkish. He said, what do you know about Turkey? And I said, absolutely nothing. I didn't even know it existed until this moment. So I went, moved, my wife came down to join me from Portland, and we took up housekeeping in Monterey. I just loved it there and spent a year of 47 weeks, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week of nothing but language. Six people in the classroom. Different instructor every hour. It's a total immersion program. And at the end of that time, every single member of our group, all six of them, qualified as UN interpreter translator ratings, which is the top of the heap. I graduated second in my class to a Russian who had spent some time in Turkey. And from there, my wife and I were transferred to Izmir, Turkey, where I was assigned as the interpreter for a three-star general who was the commander of the Allied forces of Southeastern Europe. This is a picture of me standing behind him doing a translation or interpreting at a press conference that he was. That's a very skinny me. So I spent, I had actually two functions there. One was as his interpreter translator, even though they also had native indigenous personnel that did that, but he liked the idea of having an American follow him around at parties and conferences and act as his interpreter, because he wanted to make sure he was getting the straight skinny. He was not so sure that he was getting that from the Turkish people. Are wonderful people. I spent 3 years among them, totally immersed in Turkey, and they're wonderful people, but their honesty, as far as feelings, is somewhat limited. They don't want to embarrass themselves or their country or their people or whatever. So occasionally if the general would say, what's happening over there, what he would tell them was happening in English was completely different than my understanding of what was going on. So he liked to have an American interpreter with him. While we were there, my wife and I flew to Beirut, Lebanon, and adopted our two children, a boy and a girl. Boy, 18 months old, Michael, and daughter, Kelly, who was 5 months old at the time. And then we were there about another year before I came back after my 3 years was up.
And you lived there on in amongst the people?
Oh yes, there are no military bases there. We lived in an apartment in Izmir. It's interesting. Wendy is my second wife. We've been married 29 years now, and 5 years ago, we went. She had to go to London on business, and so I went along with, tagged along with her, and the day before we were due to fly back, she says, "I have a surprise for you." She says, "I booked tickets for us to Istanbul, and down to Izmir to spend some time. So we're going to spend another week in Turkey." And so I went back to Izmir, and whoever said you can never go home absolutely was wrong. I mean, it was as if I had just woke up that morning to go to work. Nothing had changed except the city had sprawled somewhat on the outskirts. There were some newer high-rise hotels. But basically, everything was the same way, the same horse-drawn carts and carriages, the same friendly, wonderful people, same great food, beautiful setting. I mean, it was absolutely perfect. The day that before we were due to leave Izmir and fly back to the States, my wife said, "Is there any way we can spend another week here?" And she did not want to go to Turkey initially. She had a completely different impression of what it would be like. And that was an amazing tour of duty, and it was also another turning point. Because of my language capabilities, I was approached by a military intelligence to be recruited by them. And it was kind of interesting how it happened. One day my supervisor came in and he handed me a set of orders and some tickets. And I said, "What is this?" He says, "You're flying to Rome on Monday. By way of Athens. You'll spend the night in Athens and then on to Rome, and then from Rome down to Naples, to AFSOUTH headquarters, where you'll be interviewed." And I said, "Interviewed for what?" And he says, "I don't know. But I can only assume, you know, it's got something to do with being a spook, you know, of some sort." So when I got it, it's interesting in that, keeping that in mind, that I might be recruited into military intelligence, I thought, well, why would they book me overnight in Athens, actually 2 days in Athens, and then overnight in Rome? And then, so I thought, they must be following me. Tendency to be a little paranoid at this point, right? Well, as it turns out, the major who interviewed me in Naples, who was later a compatriot of mine in Vietnam, so many years later, I met him again over there. He said, "How did you like your little vacation we booked for you?" And I said, "What vacation?" He said, "Well, a couple days in Rome and in Athens, isn't that a vacation?" He said, "Where'd you go? What'd you do?" And I said, "I saw every church and museum that I could find." He said, "Oh, what a waste of a good vacation."
What year was that then?
That was 1962. And I was accepted by military intelligence, and my next duty assignment was at Fort Holabird, Maryland, at the home of the Intelligence Corps. And then went through a six-month training class there as a special agent in military intelligence, which I can't get into in great detail except to say that it was a wonderful experience, and got a lot out of it. And it set the next whatever, 8 years or how long had that been, right? I think I spent a total of 16 years in dealing in military intelligence one way or the other. My first assignment out of military intelligence school, ironically enough, was Eugene, Oregon. We had at that time a two-man resident office in the basement of the postal building, right across the hall from the two FBI agents who were stationed there at that time, and conducting primarily background investigations for people that had applied for security clearances in the military. So this will really get you. Here I'm fully trained now in Turkish, and I'm trained in military intelligence. Do they send me back to Turkey? No. 6 months after I graduated from intelligence school, they shipped me back to Korea. But this time, of course, under different circumstances. I was in civilian clothing status, flew commercial. It was an absolutely fascinating assignment. And as soon as I got there, I was assigned to a detail to capture North Korean espionage agents that were infiltrating into the South. we set up a capture team, and I brought a photograph here of my team. I'm standing in the back row there, and those gentlemen are members of the Republic of Korean Counterintelligence Corps, and those in the front are CIA agents of South Korea. And we would set up and camp out at an intended landing point for an infiltrating agent, and then attempt to capture them alive if we could. I wrote a novel that was published last year called The Eye of the Viper. I have that on my website. Basically, it deals with a fictitious Dan Daly and his pal Bull working in this area of capturing agents and what happens after they're recruited and doubled and so forth. So that was a fascinating assignment. Just about a year and 3 months there.
So did you actually capture any?
Yes, we did. Yeah. Well, only captured one alive. There's a tendency for them, they're indoctrinated to the point where they're almost like on a suicide mission. And they're, depending on how they come in, they use various different ways of getting into the country. Most of ours were water landings where they were brought offshore in a civilian fishing boat, put in a life raft, and then they row offshore, and then they carry rubber-proof, waterproof bags, and then they get on their clothing, which is all of local manufacture and everything, and then infiltrate. Well, when they leave, and they get into that, leave the fishing boat and get into that raft, they were handed a hand grenade, and then a crewman would pull the pin out of the hand grenade and either throw it away or put it in his pocket. And so when they come ashore, they've got this in their hand. And if they're immediately surrounded, of course, they're going to let it go and take people out with them. So in two instances, they did that, not where it hurt any of us because we were far enough off. They just realized that this wasn't going anywhere at that point, so they would commit suicide. But we did capture one agent during my tour there.
But again, your Turkish didn't help.
Not at all, but I picked up Korean very quickly at that point, enough to get into trouble anyway. So, yeah. I didn't use any of the Korean that I learned when I was an 18-year-old over there running around, so that would not have been appropriate under the circumstances.
So. So how long did that assignment?
Just a year. Mm-hmm. And then when I came back from there, it's interesting, I always ended up in San Francisco after having been in Korea. I was assigned to the 115th Military Intelligence Corps headquarters at Presidio, San Francisco, and lived in Oakland and worked back and forth at various different things. Primarily, I was involved in technical intelligence at that time, photography and other surreptitious activities. But I was also involved as a photographer during the riots at Berkeley on campus. And I was there at the time that Mario Savio was being held in a police car and everybody was surrounded and right on campus. And I was there taking pictures and just really enjoying myself.
But blended in as a student? So
not at all. Well, of course not. You know, white sidewall haircut and olive drab camera. You know what I mean?
Oh, okay.
But it didn't. Nobody bothered us.
In the meantime, your family was.
They were all there, living with me, and
okay.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Okay.
And then I was there for about 2 years, and then I was. Where did I go from there? Oh, I was transferred then to Italy, to Naples, back where I started with them, which is kind of interesting. A small field office at the Allied Forces Southern Europe headquarters in Naples, but my territory was the whole Mediterranean area. So I traveled back to Turkey many times, was able to use my language then, and spent 6 months on temporary duty in Malta, which was an interesting assignment. Just all over the Mediterranean, back in Athens occasionally. After I was there 2 years, I was promoted to chief warrant officer and was transferred. I took a lateral assignment to Stuttgart, Germany, where I was the desk officer for about a year, meaning I was controlling case officers who are field officers working with espionage agents. We worked strictly double agents, East Germans or Hungarian or Czech agents that came across the border that were captured by us retrained and redirected back against their own intelligence services. Those are double agents. And that's what I worked with. So although I was sitting in a desk doing it at that time, which was kind of discouraging, and having to wear a uniform that I hadn't worn in like 5-6 years, it was good training. And while I was there, I was long overdue for Vietnam. We're of military intelligence, I say we, is a very small organization. And no matter where you go, you run into people you know. I had 3 different assignments in MI and had the same sponsor who greeted me on all 3 of those occasions. We became longtime family friends. They now live up in Washington. When I got there, actually I went over with another buddy of mine, Sammy Little, who I'd been stationed with in Germany and some other places. We were sent to, we didn't go right to Vietnam. I was sent to Fort Bliss, Texas for a whole year of Vietnamese language. So I went through the 47-week course there with the Academy of Language Sciences. And after graduating from Vietnamese language school, was sent to Vietnam, flew in with my buddy, Sammy Little, who just passed away here a couple years ago, and landed in Cameron Bay. Like the airlines, this is an American Airlines airplane, by the way, contract. The stewardess, as we're coming into Cameron Bay, says, "Please be advised that if the aircraft should come under attack from enemy fire while on the runway, the aircraft will stop immediately, the exit doors will open, and you'll dismount the aircraft and get down in the ditches alongside the runway." This is not your basic, we're flying into Portland sort of, you know, welcome to Portland. This is welcome to the safest air base, I'm using finger quotes, the safest air base on the planet, right, at that time. It had not come under enemy fire for several months. Of course, Murphy's Law came into play. My very first night there, we were told that if a siren goes off, it means that we're under probable attack from the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese Army, and you'll immediately leave the building and get in the pipe bunkers that are sandbagged on each side of the building. So sure enough, about 11 o'clock, I didn't hear a siren or anything, but somebody come running up, one of the cadre of the unit, and he says, "We're under attack." Somebody said, "I didn't hear a siren." He says, "It's broken." So, get down there right away. The sappers are coming through the wire, meaning the enemy is using satchel charges with explosives, and then they throw them in the buildings and as they go by. And so I rush out of there with everybody else, and we're laying in this tube, this big corrugated tube. Well, after being in there a couple hours, I announced that with the other officers there that, "I don't know about you guys, but I have to go to the bathroom." So I made a dash for the latrine, which was near the wire, and it was all screened in with mosquito wire, and was in there watching the war go on, unfold on the airbase below me. The biggest problem there, or event that they did, was they threw a satchel charge into a hospital ward and killed a bunch of recovering American troops that were in there. So after the all clear finally rang and they captured these 2 sappers and killed them, I went back into the barracks I was staying in, and there's my buddy Sammy Little on his rack still sound asleep. He'd missed the whole war. His first day in country, in the safest place, right? From there, I had orders for the 1st Cavalry Division. I wanted to go to 1st Cav, but as our unit would have it, no matter where you go, that isn't where you're ordered to, that isn't where you end up. Somebody down in Saigon saw my name on a roster, and they needed somebody down in the Delta, in the 4th Corps, in the southern tip of Vietnam, was Vietnamese and had background dealing with double agents. So I was waylaid out of that assignment, and then flew down to, along with Sammy, he was also assigned down there to a different little city. So I spent about a year and 4 months in Canto, which is in the northern part of the Delta of that area, and as a case officer. So I was actually working directly with espionage agents that were out in the field. These were people, Vietnamese, that had infiltrated into enemy units and assimilated with them or had contacts in them and could feed back information to me. I wrote a short story about, a true story, about an episode that occurred while I was there that's published in the Oregon Writers Colony every periodically puts out an anthology, and I have that on my website, I believe. It's called In Our Own Voices, and it's members of the Oregon Writers Colony's short stories and poems and so forth that are published. The story that I submitted was accepted by jury and was published in that book last year about an incident that had a tremendous effect on me. And working as a case officer, or any intelligence officer, saying, well, you collect intelligence for one purpose. That's so that the end user can take that and either protect troops or to take offensive action, whatever it might be. In my case, most of the targets that were being reported to me were targets of bombing. B-52 arc light strikes, massive bombings, or naval aircraft fire. And to me, working as a case officer and briefing and giving my reports is just part of the day-to-day job. It's like reading the paper, like working the crossword puzzle after a while. But one day, I was supposed to meet some friends who were civilian, a doctor and a nurse who were civilian volunteers working in Vietnam at that time. Another unsung era of heroes. Those people are fantastic. Pediatricians that give up their million-dollar practice to come over and do surgery for club feet and things like that for orthopedic surgeons and for children, natives. So anyway, I was on my way over to the province hospital to meet these friends to go to happy hour.
Right.
And as I'm walking down the road, the afternoon surge of wounded, I call the walking wounded, that come in from the villages that have just been bombed or had some sort of action taken in them, are making their way to the provincial hospital because it's the only treatment facility for civilians. And I'm walking along trying to avoid contact with them. And when I get to the hospital, I go into great detail about it in this book, but I'll cut to the chase. When I went in the operating part of the hospital where the operating suites are, I'm waiting for this friend of mine to come out of surgery, and I hear this kind of a quiet moaning voice, and I look down, and there was a woman, a Vietnamese woman, lying on a stretcher on the floor, a woman probably in her 80s, snow white hair, tied up, beautifully coiffed, wearing a white aoudai, which is the long dress they wear, a white silk dress, except that she's just covered in fresh blood from the shoulder and around the neck. And she asked for something, and I stooped down, and she wanted water. So I didn't know if I should give her water or not. If she's going to surgery, you don't. And fortunately, this friend of mine came out of surgery, and I said, what's her story? And so she's dying. She has a neck carotid artery, and we don't have any way of doing that type of neurosurgery in this hospital. So it's just no way we can do it, and she won't last very long. I just brought her in out of the heat to bring her in the air conditioning part of the hospital. So I got her a glass of water. She said it was all right. Got her a glass of water, and I stooped down and lifted her head, and she started sipping that water like a cat, and smiled at me. She was the most beautiful woman I think I'd ever seen in my life, and she died right there. Well, I had my hand under her. And
so that's some of
on the way back to my office, I'm thinking about, did she come from that village that I'd ordered an airstrike on the day before, and I didn't order, but had provided intel on? Was she a victim of something that I did? And at that moment, I felt now what a bombardier must feel when they unleash this horrific firestorm on top of people down below, but they're never close enough to it. Because when their flight lands back at the airbase, they go to the officers' club and pop down a few belts, and life goes on. But this incident in my life brought that to point. But it did. People have asked me, well, did you stop doing what you did? No, of course not. I continued to work for another 3 years afterward. I was reassigned from Vietnam back to Portland, Oregon. That was my twilight assignment because I would retire here. My 20 years was up. And of course, I was running background investigations again, clearing people for security clearances. So it's a different perspective. But in looking back, if I had was going to be there for another tour of duty, would I continue to do the same thing? Well, of course I would. That's my job, and nothing that I do or say is going to keep people from being, innocent people from being killed. Collateral damage is exactly that. They're too close to the action. Well, maybe they're too close because they're the enemy as well. Vietnam was interesting in that every single Vietnamese is a Vietnamese, be it North or South, like Korea, same thing. Many of them are Viet Cong, or recruited by the North Vietnamese government to the Viet Cong army was as large, if not larger, than the North Vietnamese army. So you really never knew. You had 5 and 6 year old kids that were planting bombs out in the roadway. We learned that if you're driving on a dirt country road, and you're driving along and you see kids sitting up on the hillside watching the road, as you approach them, if they covered their ears, you better stop and find out what's in the road ahead. You hear the stories about women and children being killed during the raids on these villages, but which ones, you know, pose a threat and which don't? It's like a police officer that's called in, like that horrific thing that happened today, you know, down in Virginia. They have to act according to their training. Well, it's the same way with the military. But what it did, and I'll wrap it up with that point, is it brought to mind that when you're going to report things, you better verify, like newspapers. You better talk to 5 or 6 or however many different sources that you get as you can to verify that you're getting the truth. Because if you don't, you're going to hurt somebody, be it inadvertently or however. So I've been asked to speak to several different groups. I belong to an association called Association for Intelligence Officers, which consists of CIA, FBI. Anybody that's ever worked in counterintelligence is a member of that organization. And my message to all of those that are still on active duty, including an online group that I belong to, a counterintelligence discussion group on the internet, half of whom are still working over in Afghanistan and in Iraq right now. My message to them is verify, verify, verify. Because your end user is going to take a lot of faith in what you're telling them. And they're going to take action based on information, not on assumptions, but on hard-bound information. Because in the end, you're the one that's going to be, you know, holding that 80-year-old lady in your arms and getting her blood on your hands.
So do you see some parallels, David, to today's war with what you saw and encountered in those earlier situations with people that you could not recognize as being dangerous?
It's probably even worse because, except for, like in Iraq, for example, and Afghanistan for that measure too, nobody's wearing uniforms, right? They're all of the same ethnic origin, the same dress, the same customs, mannerisms. Yeah. You just really can't put a finger on who's a bad guy and who isn't.
So you don't know who's a terrorist, and they hide the munitions in these Iraq situations. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you can't tell.
Yeah. One of the things I do find completely reprehensible about the terrorists or the organizations that are fighting us in Iraq and in Afghanistan right now, particularly in Iraq, in that those infiltrators, which are primarily non-Iraqis that are coming in from Syria and Saudi Arabia, in other words, use women and children as shields. Not even the Viet Cong ever did that. Many of them had their families with them. The Viet Cong moved around those jungles. You know, they fought the French before us. They'd been fighting for 20 years by the time we got there. And they're moving around with their women and children in their camps. So if one of those camps is targeted for a bomb, you're going to lose women and children along with it. But they're not using them as shields deliberately, where you take munitions and somebody that's hiding out from the military and put them in a room filled with women and children, right?
Which is what's happening now.
Which is what's happening now, right. Yeah.
And are there any, you mentioned your work in the intelligence area there, and are there any TV shows or movies that accurately depicted what you did in those environments?
None. Closest thing to it would be, well, yes, I should say the closest thing to it would be the unit, which is a special forces organization that works out of Central Command out of Florida. And there is such a type of unit. That's not what it's called. They're different names. But also at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, they're like firemen. They got a hot spot going on in Africa or someplace else, and they're loaded onto black aircraft and flown out to either capture an espionage agent or to bring somebody safely out of a country under siege or whatever. Those are Army people. Now, most of those teams have counterintelligence personnel assigned to them, primarily to gather intelligence during that operation and bring it back in brief. But that's probably the closest thing to it. The work that we were, the 525 MI group that operated throughout Vietnam, was broken into small little field offices. I was technically assigned to the 4th Battalion down in the 4th Corps area. My battalion consisted of like maybe 20 people. Well, that isn't even hardly a squad, let alone a battalion. And I was in Company C of the 4th Battalion, the 525. Company C, there were about 8 of us, the entire company. Assigned, we were on our own. I was not on a post. I was civilian clothes, living in a little duplex right in downtown Canto on the economy. I couldn't eat. I couldn't go to any of the military bases. I couldn't even associate with my own unit, which was about 3 blocks away. I was completely undercover for reasons, and that was to protect those agents that were bringing information to us. If one of them and I were spotted by somebody and they were able to assign me to a given military unit, they could always attack that unit or take out the agent. So I was compartmented, and most of us operated that way throughout Vietnam. Some were assigned to tactical units. The military divisions, like the 1st Cavalry Division, for example, has its own military intelligence detachment assigned to it, but primarily it's tactical intelligence for what's called force protection, to protect their unit, as opposed to what we were doing. The stuff my Chinooks were bringing me was really good stuff. I mean, targeting top level a cadre of the Viet Cong, and of matter of fact, I even had several reports of American prisoners that were being held in the jungle, where they were located. Of course, by the time anybody ever got there, they were gone, but there were signs that they had been there before.
So were there some things you're really proud of that you were able to, you could trace back to your decisions or your actions?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Could you describe any of those?
One was there was a high-level a North Vietnamese cadre who supposedly was accompanied by a Chinese intelligence officer.
This is what's a cadre?
A cadre means officer director, if you want to put that in a corporation. It wouldn't be the CEO, but it would be like a vice president or chief of operations, somebody of that sort, who has major control over a large area. And one of my new agents was not a double agent; he was an infiltrator. He was targeted against the villages, sold. Fresh fruit and vegetables that he would pick up out in the outlying areas and bring every morning to Canto to put on the marketplace there. So he had access to all of these little hamlets where the Viet Cong were underground and as much as you could be underground in a rice paddy region like that. And he gave me word that something really big was taking place because the people were given new clothes and better food, and so that usually meant that some big shot was going to show up. And so in reporting this up the line, I got words back and said, we want to target that area. We want to just blow it off the face of the earth if we can, as long as we've got confirmed intelligence that these people are there. And we're talking eyewitness. So I made arrangement with this guy who had been, he's a Vietnamese, but he'd been a prisoner of the Viet Cong himself for several years before he was released. We bought him a sampan with an outboard engine on the back of it, the whole thing. And I took, they always carry oars, even though they have an engine, because they run out of fuel. And also, when they're going into the Viet Cong controlled area at night, they cut their engines and they row their way, you know, the rear paddle out of the back of the boat. They row their way in to be quiet. Also, they don't want the Navy fighter aircraft to pick up the heat sink of an outboard motor and take them. Because we lived in a free fire zone, which meant you could fire at anything without requesting permission. So I took one of his oars and I had it cut in half and then bored out a hole in each of the end of it. And we put a transponder, a radio transmitter in there, and fed the antenna all the way up through another small hole and out in the end. And then mounted the two pieces together and spliced it with duct tape, which is most of the oars over there that were cracking or old or whatever, wrapped in duct tape anyway. And he was to go into this area at night, or in the morning when we go down there. And if the target was there with his staff, he was to take that oar and stick it in the water, just so the top of it is up, so the antenna would be. He didn't know what was in there, but he knew it was important. And he would stick that in the water and then get the hell out of Dodge, because the Navy will be ready to come in. And and that worked like a charm. They came in and unloaded on that meeting site where this meeting was going on. And the after action report on it wasn't that there were in fact North Vietnamese cadre or high ranking officers at the point at the time of the. To me, that was a great hit. You know, you really in our business in intelligence, you really don't always know what's happened after you turn the information over. You don't know how it's used, or what the end result is. And it's interesting in that about a year ago, I've requested copies of my military records, and included in there was my officer's efficiency report that had been submitted on me after I had left by my immediate commander after I had left Vietnam and came back. And I'd never seen a copy of it before. Most officers are given a copy of it, but the way we operate, it's not like the military in that respect. But there was a copy of that in my file in there. And one of the things that it said that was kind of disturbing in a way, I was kind of proud in a way, but at the same time kind of heartsick over it, was the fact that it said this case officer was directly responsible for over 100 enemy killed in action confirmed. I never had any idea what all of that did, you know, but I could probably would have added to that, and maybe even one 80-year-old lady.
Yeah. 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 Were you really fearful at any one moment or two? Do you remember?
Our city, Canto, was overrun by the Viet Cong, that part of the city, for 2 days. And so I just simply pulled down the steel shutters on my windows and locked my door in my little duplex. The other half of the duplex was occupied by a Filipino civilian who worked for the World Health Organization. And so he always had his vehicle out front with the crosses on it. So it was always, you know, and they respected that, I guess. But the worst thing that happened to me during that period of time is that I ran out of cold beer, because the power had been shut off, my refrigerator didn't work that I had, and all my beer got hot.
And for a young man of your age, that was a real big...
That's a good point, too, you know, because I went to Vietnam when I was, 34 years old? I'd served in Korea, and I'd been in the military long enough that I was more or less savvy about things and what to expect and what not to expect and so forth and so on. So I don't think I really ever had a moment where I was terrified by, I had one interesting episode. One of the few times I ever went to Saigon, I avoided Saigon like the plague, because that's where people got hurt. It's like Baghdad, you know. My friend Sammy Little and I met in Saigon on a three-day pass weekend vacation. And as we're walking down through the markets, there was an oil painter there. And he had this beautiful painting. It was framed, and it was probably about, oh, maybe 4 feet by 3 feet, something, a large oil painting. And it was a painting of one of the canals with that kind of a mustard colored water that they would have over there, and the palm, the deep, deep greens that you get. And they had a tree called a cash tree that has a red brack on it. I don't know if you've ever seen that tree, but it's bright red in the middle of all of this dark green. And I love this painting. And so I bought it. And so I'm lugging this thing around the marketplace, and we got way out in the boonies, and Little said, let's head back to the hotel. We've got to get in the morning and catch our flight. And I said, well, I'm not going to lug this painting all. He said, we'll get a taxi. So he called over one of these little small Datsun taxis, and the painting wouldn't fit in it, so he put it on the roof, and then we put our arms out the window on each side and held it in place. We get right to downtown Saigon, about a block away from the hotel, and bombs start going off. Explosions, not bombs, but explosions start going off all over the city. And the cab driver stopped right in the middle of the street, opened the door, and ran away. And there we are. You know. So we get out of the cab and take off, and we're hiding over behind a building, you know, hunkered down on the sidewalk behind a building. And I look up, and my painting's still on the roof of the car. So I got up, and I'm going, run out middle of this intersection to grab my painting and take that back with me. And I ended up having to cut it out of the frame and roll it up and bring it home. But
so 20 years you were in, mm-hmm. and then back to the States and your family, and what was next?
About a month before I retired, I was in the Portland field office of the 115th MI Group. And about a month before I was scheduled to retire, the Army had a project called Operation Transition, where they would give a retiring soldier 30 days to work for a prospective employer. And you would continue to draw your military pay, but you're not allowed to draw pay from that employer. And so I went to I was interviewed by CIA and was accepted by them in a flash because of language. But the assignment was for North Africa, and I didn't want to move my family again. I promised my wife and two kids that daddy's going to stay home this time, and you can't go with me. So I declined that offer. And then I went to an employment agency, and he's scouting around. My employment agency guy's headhunter is scouting around for positions that dealt primarily in security or law enforcement or something like that. And he says, is there anything you don't want to do? And I said, no insurance sales and no real estate. That's where all these retirees end up, you know, none of that. He said, okay, promise. So I got a call from him about 3 days later, and he said, I got an interview set up for you on Monday morning. You'll really like these people. It's a management trainee position. So it's going to start out with pretty good pay, plus a car, company car, and that was important because we didn't have one. So it was almost like a lateral transfer, so I'd be drawing double salary, you know, at that point. And I said, where is it? And he said, it's room 120 over at Crown Plaza Building in downtown Portland. I said, the company, what's the company? He said, Safeco Insurance Company. And I said, no way, I told you, no insurance sale. He said, this is not sales, this is a management position, right? Just go talk to these people, you'll love them. So I went over there, and sure enough, the division manager was a former Marine, and everybody I interviewed was former military. He loved military retirees, and any chance he could get one, he'd hire him as a marketing rep. And I love those people. It was just a great interview process, so I accepted their job, and I worked there for 30 days and then went up to Fort Lewis to the retirement ceremony and then came back to work. And then I spent 32 years in the insurance industry. I left Safeco after 5 years, and I became an independent insurance agent and had an agency in Lake Oswego for years or two, my wife and I. And then we sold it to Clark Miller here in Tualatin, Miller Insurance. Yeah. And I worked there in that office for 20 years and then retired 2.5 years ago from that. So. And now I'm a writer. I'm working on a sequel to my first novel that takes place in Korea. The first one, by the way, was supposed to be Korea and then Turkey, but the turkey book was accepted first, so I had to go back and rewrite the first one as a sequel instead of a prequel. So I'm just now wrapping that up. That should be published probably, late this fall, I would imagine.
And you're also a member of the Tualatin VFW.
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm.
So what's the advantage for being a member of that group?
You know, it's the VFW posts vary depending on where you go. Some of them are like social clubs, much like the American Legion does, where they have a bar and all of that. Our post is not that way at all. We meet once a month, and it's just a get-together, a very limited number of people. We have 120 members, but at a meeting we might have 20. We have people from going all the way back. We, up until a couple months ago, we boasted by having the oldest VFW member and the last surviving World War I vet. And he just died here. You probably read about it.
Howard?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Dale Potts right now is serving on a committee to try to raise funds for a World War I memorial in Portland, which they've never had. And, or World War, maybe World War II memorial. Is it World War I? Yeah. Yeah, in honor of Howard. And, but you meet people of all generations, you know, from all wars, from all walks of life, young and old. Originally, the VFW was mostly just World War II vets and World War I vets. So you had a lot of people. Of course, your membership is literally dying off, you know, as a result of that. We now have a lot of veterans of Afghanistan and even a couple of people that were involved in Sudan. I think even one from Grenada. And one from Panama, the one-day war we had down there. So all different types of people. Some retired, some still active in business. And our current post commander, Bill Phillips, has the RE/MAX agency right next to Hayden, the real estate agency there. He was in Operation Desert Storm. That's where he received his Foreign Service Medal.
So if you were giving some advice to students today about the lessons you've learned during your military experience, what would you share?
The military, I don't care which service it is. Of course, I'm prejudiced to the Army. But the military service offers a tremendous opportunity to both men and women, young boys and girls coming right out of high school or college, for that matter, preferably college, because they enter with a commission. And that can be an outstanding career as a commissioned officer. I wasn't commissioned until late in my career. But here's what it offers. It obviously offers world travel. You know, we just don't have troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. We've got them scattered out all over the world. There's still, my office in Italy is still going strong, where I was stationed down there. There are some real plum assignments. That we've got a large field office in Japan, several of them in Korea. But I've had two tours there, that's enough. Thank you. anyway, the sign-up bonus, the college credits, the money they can get for college is absolutely phenomenal. They'll pay for a four-year college degree. You can learn a foreign language. That course that I went through at Monterey and then all years later, the one at Fort Bliss, that year-long course, that course would probably cost the military, you know, at that time, $50,000, $60,000 to put me through that training. That's per student. So there's that opportunity. World travel, good pay, excellent pay now, as a matter of fact. And you're not going to be paid if you start out. Actually, a private right now probably made more than I made as a master sergeant at one time, but, you know, with inflation. But it's, and retirement's always there too. They'll never take that away from you, no matter what. So.
Well, anything else you'd like to share?
No, just the opportunity to have this documented so that, you know, 50, 60 years, somebody pulls something off the shelf, the Library of Congress, and reads it or listens to to the story. It's an exciting opportunity to be a party of all of this.
Well, we'll look for your books on the website.
Good.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you. Okay.